This is America on the Road, winner of the International Automotive Media Conference Gold Medal Award for Radio, and now in its 24th year on the air. Thanks for being with us as we bring you the latest automotive information from around the world, and we'll have special coverage of the North American Car of the Year for you today. America on the Road is brought to you by DrivingToday.com and the Coalition for Vehicle Choice. I'm Jack Nerad. With me is co-host Chris Teague. Chris is very excited because he's moving from one house in Maine to another house in Maine, and he writes for Ford Authority, Forbes, Driving Today, among others. Tell us all about that exciting new house there, Chris.
I think it will be most exciting not to live in a house stacked tall with boxes. But the new house will be great. I'll have a garage to do projects on cars and actually park a car for the first time. And we'll have a little bit of waterfront, too, so the view never hurts.
Wow, a little waterfront. I like that. What kind of water?
A river, not the ocean, unfortunately, but yeah. It's still better than nothing.
Yeah, I like a little river view. That would be very nice. This week, our special guest is Gary Witzenberg. He is president of the North American Car of the Year organization. I have a little bit of an in getting an interview with him because I'm vice president of that organization. He will give us a close-up look on what to expect from the 2021 North American Car, Truck, and Utility of the Year winners. They were just announced this week. He and I both participated in that program outside Detroit. In the car review segment, Chris will give us his opinion of the 2021 Lincoln Corsair. That sounds like a nice vehicle. And I'm going to tell you about my recent 500-mile drive with my daughter, my youngest daughter, in the 2021 Ford Bronco Sport, kind of real-world test of the vehicle. But before we do that, let's take a look at the latest in automotive news. And you've got some kind of radical news for us, don't you, Chris? What's that?
I came across this earlier today, and it just kept getting more interesting the more I read about it. So the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, which is virtual this year because of COVID-19, it's usually in Las Vegas. As part of the show, Cadillac General Motors showed up with a visualization of a flying car that they plan to make. We don't have much of a timeline on when that's going to happen, but they said that it will have four rotors or propellers. I'm not an aviation expert, so I have no idea which of the two it actually is. It'll be powered by a 90 kilowatt hour EV motor and can travel at speeds of up to 56 miles an hour. Not to be outdone, though, Fiat Chrysler also released or announced its plans to mass produce flying cars by 2023, and it is partnering with a company called Archer to do that. I should mention that all these are probably going to start off as air taxis, so some sort of mass transportation there. But I can't help but wonder, and this is something I got caught on, Jack, is I don't see or have not heard of any infrastructure being built to accommodate mass-produced flying cars. Have you?
I have not, and I'm wondering how much infrastructure they need. I mean, this kind of dates back, it probably dates back way before I was a kid, but even dating back to when I was a kid is a long, long time ago. And, you know, the Popular Science and Popular Mechanics magazines of the day would always have cover stories about flying cars, and they were always promised to us as being imminent, you know, within the next several years. And it all seems so wonderful because you wouldn't have traffic congestion. You'd, you know, just take off from your house. And I think most of these would be vertical takeoff kind of things as opposed to requiring a runway and landing strips and that kind of stuff. I would think they would be mostly like giant drones. Isn't that kind of your take on what these things are likely to be like?
It is. I'm thinking, yes, and you're absolutely right. So some of the images, it looks kind of like a drone with a single seat. And so, you know, this would be probably for an autonomous trip, you know, short trip around town. But I'm thinking more about like urban areas. I mean, are these things going to set down right in the middle of the sidewalk or the street? I guess we'll have to wait and find out. But
yeah, that was always
that's very interesting. That
it was always the question, right? I mean, and the unanswered question was, okay, how would one actually use this if you were to have it? And you know, would you fly over to the grocery store and you know land it in the parking lot, or and then take off from the parking lot and zip home, or maybe, I guess. I don't know. Good question, right?
It's actually promising that they're probably going to start autonomously because I couldn't imagine the training required to not run into someone else as you're parking your flying car at the grocery store.
Yeah, true enough. Well, we hear so many problems with drones in various neighborhoods and people hating drones and wanting to shoot them down and getting the old shotgun out to take down drones. I can imagine what it would be like if we have human-sized drones zipping around various neighborhoods. It'd probably really be crazy. And here's something else that I found a bit crazy. And it was announced at the same time, or virtually the same time, as we announced the North American Car of the Year. And that is that the North American International Auto Show, which was typically held in January every year and then was postponed from January. They were going to move to a midsummer or a June date, I guess. That's not really midsummer. But as summer broke, and then that all got flushed out the window because of COVID. Now they're not going to have a show at all. Its 2021 auto show is off. In its stead, there will be an event called Motorbella, two words, Motorbella, that's going to be held from September 21 through 26 in Pontiac, Michigan, close by to Detroit, Michigan. And it's going to be an outdoor extravaganza of automobiledom, but not a traditional auto show in any way, shape, or form. And I guess what this means is they have decided not to solicit manufacturers to have traditional auto show type displays. Probably not getting a lot of car manufacturers who are signing up. So they decided, okay, we're going to not do that this year. And instead, we're going to do this essentially kind of like a state fair or county fair, except all around cars. And what's your take on that, Chris? What do you think about that idea?
I think it's pretty reasonable. It may not be what we as journalists expect or even get excited about every year, but it puts some more time in between now or the original date and the new date. So more people presumably will have been vaccinated by then. They're moving it outside, so that helps out too. I'm no virologist or immunologist, but I've heard that being outside is helpful. So I think it's reasonable. What it ends up looking like, I think, will be interesting to see, but I can't blame them for trying.
Yeah, absolutely. And something similar was going to be part of the auto show, and I think this is just a way to extend themselves a little bit and not overpromise that you would have something that is akin to an auto show at this event. Instead, it will be more of a showcase for off-roading capabilities. There's going to be vehicle demonstrations at this place. I think just a lot of experiences around the car, and I think a car being a dynamic object, doing it outside where you can see and actually drive cars and ride in cars is probably a very, very good thing. So, I'm kind of excited about it. I'll be excited to see what it's like. We'll just have to see how that unfolds when it unfolds in September. And then the following year, I think in 2022, we will see a more traditional North American International Auto Show at around the same dates, which would perhaps conflict with an overseas, a European event. That was typically when the Frankfurt Motor Show was. I think Frankfurt has been superseded now by the Munich Auto Show that is purported to going to take place this year, but we'll have to see what happens then. So that's what's going on that score. Motorbella in September versus instead of the traditional Detroit Auto Show.
Hopefully by then we can all get on planes and enjoy life again.
Right. Well, I was on a plane as recently as yesterday, so one can. And I was amazed at how many people are in all kinds of different types of outfits, let me tell you. I saw everything from people who looked like they were scuba diving to people who looked like they were just going for a walk in the park, all kinds of different ways of dealing with the threatened virus here. Well, here's another news story. It is on what might be a very hot small SUV coming to America. Hyundai in Europe has taken the wraps off, almost. They actually didn't unpeel the camouflage, but they are showing off the Hyundai Kona N. N is going to be, or is, the performance arm of Hyundai, kind of like M is for BMW, or AMG is for Mercedes-Benz. The Kona N is going to debut in Europe later this year, and it's going to be pretty cool. It could have as much as 275 horsepower. That's a lot for that little vehicle. 260 pound-feet of torque from a two-liter turbocharged four-cylinder engine. And it's going to have the 8-speed wet clutch dual clutch transmission. So you got to like that. I think it would be exciting should it appear in the United States. And I think there's probably the good chance it will. It probably will not appear this year, at least for sale, but might appear next year as a 2022 or maybe even a 2023 model year vehicle.
I'll take it. I think the standard cone is great. Hyundai and Kia both have, they both build a great or use a great dual clutch transmission. So no complaints there. The Veloster N was great. And I keep saying great, but the Veloster N was a solid effort. And so were the efforts they're putting into the Elantra car, the Elantra line. So I'll be excited to see where they come out. I guess I've said this to you before, but the more family oriented performance cars that are available, the happier I will be. So no complaints from me.
Yeah, exactly. I'm right with you. Well, when we come back, we will be road testing a couple of interesting vehicles that I think a lot of people will find very palatable, right? You were driving the Lincoln Corsair for 2021. I was driving a much talked about car, the Ford Bronco Sport. I took a long drive in it with my youngest daughter to take her away to school. So we'll talk about that when we come back. With Chris Teague, this is Jack Nerad with you. And thanks so much for being with us on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road with Chris Teague. Jack Nerad back with you. And we're so glad you're with us. We really do appreciate you joining us here on America on the Road. It is road test time. And it seems like there's a never-ending stream of crossovers to talk about in the marketplace. we're certainly going to talk about a bunch of them in our interview segment coming up. But right now, Chris, tell us all about the Lincoln Corsair for 2021.
Yeah, you're not kidding about the stream of crossovers, but this is a good one. It's the 2021 Corsair. This is the reserve trim that I'm testing this week. It comes with a 2.3-liter turbocharged inline four. And the striking thing here is the horsepower number. It's a 280 horsepower inline four in a vehicle that's not all that much larger than a Ford Escape. This vehicle is actually built on the same platform as the Ford Escape, though it's hard to tell that that's the case between the two. The Corsair is very striking styling, a very spacious interior. No issues at all with headroom in the back seats or the front seats. The child seats fit perfectly in the rear. I should note, though, that the difference here between this and the Escape doesn't end with the appearance, though. This one starts at around $57,000, where the Escape tops out at, I think, at around $40,000. But that money buys top-end leather interior, a Revel or Revel stereo system with 14 speakers. It's got in-dash navigation on an 8-inch touchscreen with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. And a 12.3-inch, I think, is the measurement digital display with a head-up display as well. Every safety feature known to man, from blind spot monitors to forward collision warnings. And I'm currently sitting in the 2021 Corsair with the heated and massaging seats going. And I have to say, those are quite nice as well. So on the road, this thing has plenty of juice to get going. 280 horsepower from a turbocharged engine. It's a little bit slow on the pickup, but once it hits the turbo, it will definitely scoot. The ride is very, very smooth on the $700 adaptive suspension package that this vehicle has. It's Lincoln quiet, as you would expect from a larger vehicle. And it really takes a lot of those touches from the Navigator and the Nautilus and the larger vehicles, and shrinks them down into a manageable package. There's the floating dash, the signature piano key gear shift, which after a little bit of adjustment, I've warmed up to it quite a bit. And as I mentioned, a full suite of technology, both safety and entertainment features. If you can spend the money, I would definitely spring for this. I think it's a good competitor to smaller Audis like the Q3 or the BMW X3 or X1 or the X2, I think there is now as well. So it competes well against the Europeans. The price is a little steep, but you get quite a bit for what you're paying here.
I think it does compete very well against the Europeans, but I think the sad fact is that probably very few people who would consider a European SUV are going to take a look at the Lincoln Corsair. I just don't think that's going to happen. I think more likely they would consider other domestics and maybe some maybe a vehicle from, say, Hyundai or Genesis or something like that, as opposed to the Corsair. And much the pity. I just think the people who are have their nose in the air about European SUVs are missing out with the Corsair, because I think there's a lot to offer about it. I think Lincoln has done a very good job. Ford Motor Company has done a very good job in differentiating the Corsair from the Ford products. As you say, you don't look at one and think it's the other. There's definite differences from the exterior styling and certainly in the interior when you add all that extra cash that you're putting into it. I guess you expect something out of it from the interior, and you pretty much get it. So I think it's a really good execution. I'm not sure that it is as well received in the marketplace as it probably deserves to be.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even comparing domestically, it sits very favorably against the Cadillac XT4, XT5 for what you're paying. The interior feels much more premium than the XT4 or the 5. The price is a little bit higher in some configurations, but there's never been a point in time in this vehicle where I felt like, you know, if I had spent the money on it, I would be shortchanged. Even though it's a smaller crossover, a smaller SUV, it's got everything a big Lincoln has, and probably then some, because it's not spread out so far away. So, it's a shame, but like you said, it's definitely a solid effort.
Absolutely. And worth taking a look at. I had the chance to take a long look at the Ford Bronco Sport. I had a first edition vehicle this time around. And I know we've talked about this vehicle on the show before. Of course, it's one of the hottest vehicles, we think, to come into the market in a long, long time. And what I did differently this time was the previous time, in an event that was sponsored by Ford, I had a chance to drive it primarily off-road. There was not that much on-road component to it. And of course, most people are going to be driving these vehicles on the road most of the time, and occasionally they'll go off-road. And certainly the Ford Bronco Sport has the chops to go off-road. I mean, I found that out the last time around. So this time around, I was taking my daughter about 200 miles away to college for the winter quarter in college. And she brought home a lot of stuff. She came home before Thanksgiving. And the goal was to see if we could get all that stuff into the Bronco Sport and then get her up to where she was going, to her college, very successfully. And it turned out even better than we expected, actually. I was very, very pleased with the way the Bronco Sport handled on mostly the freeways that we were driving on. Plenty of power in terms of acceleration, excellent. 245 horsepower from its 2-liter four-cylinder engine, turbocharged four-cylinder engine. 275 pound-feet of torque, all very accessible. Pretty good fuel economy, 23 miles per gallon combined. You know, that's not fabulous, but this is an all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive vehicle that's meant to go off-road, so it has that kind of gearing and those kinds of tires. What was really telling to me, and frankly, we had some questions about, would this be able to swallow up all the stuff she had brought home in a much larger vehicle? And it did it with actually aplomb, very, very simply. And there we could have put more stuff in it, a lot more stuff. And I did some checking about maximum luggage volume and compared it to the most logical competitor for the Ford Bronco Sport, and that is the Jeep Cherokee Trailhawk. And you're looking at 60.1 cubic feet of total cargo volume versus 54.7. So that's a much larger cargo area. In terms of the cargo, the actual cargo area with the seats all in use, it has 29 cubic feet of cargo area versus 25.8 cubic feet in the Jeep Cherokee Trailhawk. And, you know, we're big fans of the Trailhawk. Don't get me wrong. I like that vehicle a lot. But the Ford has more interior volume, and it's more useful, very accessible, easy to get into, really large rear hatch, squared off rear hatch. So it just handled this very, very well. In terms of interior creature comforts, they were all there. It's equipped with a Sync 3 system, not the Sync 4 system, but a Sync 3 system with 8-inch touchscreen. It's very compatible with Apple CarPlay, which I was using. I'm not sure about it. It is compatible with Android Auto, but I don't have that system, so I didn't test it with that. It does have Sirius XM satellite radio. I actually listened to a playoff football game on my way home from this event while I was deadheading it back home. But I did this about 400 to 500 mile round trip in one day with plenty of ease. And, you know, we stopped off at grocery stores. We stopped off at a discount store to get a bunch of stuff to just set her up for the new term. So this is a real-world test of the Ford Bronco Sport. It's excellent off-road, and I think it doesn't beat you up. It's very quiet, easy to use, and handles really well on the highway. So I think that was very telling.
That's good to hear. I'm still waiting to get behind the wheel of one. You've been behind the wheel of two, so I'll be jealous from over here. But it's good to hear that it's great on the highway, because so many people, the initial presentation of the vehicle was done off-road. So that became the sort of overwhelming opinion, as everyone drove it off-road. And now people are starting to get them out on the highway, both from journalist testing and from actual buyers. So I'm encouraged to hear that it does well, almost as well on the road as it does in the dirt.
Yeah, I was really impressed with it. And of course, this came at a price. I had a first edition, which is their highest zootiest, and I think even sold out model. Its price started at $38,000, $38,160. So that's a pretty stiff MSRP for a compact SUV. You know, certainly there are many others that are less expensive than that. But in terms of presence on the road, what it will do off-road, all its off-road capabilities, and then how it performs in everyday use, I think Ford has a big winner here, and I think they're going to sell an absolute boatload of the Ford Bronco Sport.
Well, let's hope we see the big Bronco coming soon.
Yes, and it's over the horizon, and I think we will see it soon. But I think in the meantime, a lot of people are going to be quite satisfied with the Ford Bronco Sport, and we're going to see a bunch of those on the road before very long. And when we come back, we're going to be taking your listener questions. So we'd love to hear from you. Give us a question, and we'll try to answer it on an upcoming show. With Chris Teague, Jack Nerad with you, and stay with us right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road with Chris Teague. Jack Nerad back with you, and we're so glad you're with us. We really do appreciate you joining us on America on the Road. We're here to help. That's why we're here, and you can help us, actually, by passing us along to fellow car buffs that you know. If you like the show, maybe they will too. So we'd appreciate it if you'd pass that along. And now we'd like to pass along a little knowledge that we've gleaned through the years here, maybe through the minutes more recently. Chris, it's question and answer time. What's your question for us?
Today's question came in. It is, what does EPC mean in cars? EPC.
EPC. Well, we have this alphabet soup in cars now, right? And a lot of it has to do with the electronic systems on cars. And you might guess that the letter E stands for electronic, and yes, it does. EPC stands for electronic power control. And it's a computerized ignition and engine management system that is used in Volkswagen Group vehicles. And of course, Volkswagen builds Volkswagens, duh. Audis, Porsches, and some others, Bentleys. I'm not sure Bentley uses EPC so much, but they probably do. It was designed initially just to manage ignition. I go back to when we had points and condensers, and then we went to transistorized ignition. And then we have electronic ignition and throttle functions, and that's where EPC came in. Its role kind of has been expanded in many models. It kind of oversees a variety of electronic systems, or at least interacts with electronics systems. So, for example, if electronic stability control were to experience a problem in your vehicle, in your Volkswagen Group vehicle, it would affect EPC, and EPC then might shut down the engine or put it into limp home mode, because it doesn't want to injure the car. So all these systems kind of work together these days. The typical car has an electronic control unit, or ECU, that essentially operates as the brain of the car. It tells the different functions what to do. And if something malfunctions, it also picks that up and then does things like flashes warning lights and changes the operation of the vehicle. Your check engine light is liable to go on at the same time you get an EPC flash on your dash. And again, it's likely that the cruise control will cease to work at that point. Maybe some of the other systems won't be working either. And then EPC might institute this limp home mode so you don't blow up your engine as you're trying to get to the side of the road or get to a service station or something where it can be fixed.
Well, that's interesting, especially, you know, I would think that's a very obscure thing, but Volkswagen makes a ton of cars, so there are probably plenty of people who need to know that.
Yeah, and essentially, similar systems are at work on virtually every car out there now. I mean, these electronic systems, computerized electronic systems, are all over the place in every car. You can't escape them, and nor should you. They do so much for us. I mean, what they're able to do in terms of emissions controls, for example, for fuel economy and for lessening pollution is just absolutely amazing. So we want to have these systems, and we also want to know when they're not working. And one thing that if you get an EPC light on your dash to track down what the problem is, because it could be a lot of things. It could be something very, very minor. And sometimes it's even just the sensor is malfunctioning. But oftentimes it's something minor, but it could be something major. You should use an OBD2 scanner to check that out. A lot of people don't have those. I actually went out and bought one not long ago, a few years ago, actually. And I found it to be extremely handy, and it was a lot less expensive than I expected. And, you know, I'd recommend it's something that a lot of people think about buying. I think you can probably get one for well less than $50. And then when you have a code or something comes up, you can check it out and, you know, be your own mechanic if you'd like.
I agree. And you could even get one. I tested one a few months ago. I think it's called iFixit or something like that, that connects to your phone via Bluetooth. So you don't even need the giant expensive unit to test anymore. So
yeah, well, the unit I have fits in the palm of your hand. It's about the size of a cell phone, maybe a little bit bigger. And it not only reads the codes, but then it translates them to you in plain English. So you have at least some kind of sense about what the problem is. And all that for less than $50, I think maybe well less than $50, it strikes me as a pretty good investment.
Absolutely.
And when we come back, we will be chatting with an old friend of mine. And he is very old. His name is Gary Witzenberg. He is the president of the North American Car of the Year organization, the jury, which I serve as vice president. And we will be talking about the recently, just this week, announcements of the North American Car of the Year, the North American Truck of the Year, and the North American Utility Vehicle of the Year. So stay with us for that. With Chris Teague, Jack Nerad with you. Thanks for being with us right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. Jack Nerad with you, and we are outside Detroit, Michigan. We're actually in Troy, Michigan, and I am honored to be with the president of the North American Car of the Year jury, Gary Witzenberg, an old friend of mine, guy I've known for decades, and a very talented writer, car reporter, and we've just come off introducing and announcing the North American Car, Truck, and Sport Utility of the Year. Gary, thanks so much for being with us, number one.
Thank you, Jack. Good to be with you.
Let's talk a bit about North American Car of the Year and North American Truck of the Year and North American Utility of the Year. It's a very prestigious award program. I guess we shouldn't keep people waiting. Let's tell them what the winners are for 2021. Would you do the honors, please?
Sure. We just came out of the presentations online, live, remote, virtual. Car of the Year, Hyundai Elantra. And that isn't just a single car. That was actually a family, which includes a hybrid and includes a inline performance version. And that could be one reason they won the award, because they were basically launching all of those almost simultaneously.
Right.
For Truck of the Year, not much of a surprise, because it was the Ford F-150, which is the biggest selling vehicle in the country for how many, 44 years or something straight.
Yeah.
But also because the other two contenders were models of an existing line. The Ram TRX, high performance, 702 horsepower desert racer version of the Ram. And the kind of along the same line, the Jeep Gladiator Mojave, which was a desert racer, not that much power, but a otherwise very capable desert racer kind of
mid-sized truck, yeah,
of the Gladiator, or the Gladiator, which won last year, by the way, was last year's truck of the year.
Yeah.
So it was unlikely that the Mojave version would have won this year. So Ford F-150 is not a surprise winner. We kind of expected that. Although the TRX, the Ram TRX, is very impressive.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm sure we got a lot of votes.
And we can dive in, but let's give the final winner is the Utility. What was that?
Utility, really tough category, Jack, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
We had, I forget, 27 or something originally, narrowed it down to 15 with our first vote, semifinalists. That's unusually high. Normally we have 10 or 12 that are considered semifinalists based on that vote. And of those 15, the three that emerged as finalists, as you know, were the Genesis GV80, the Land Rover Defender, and the Ford Mustang Mach-E. And the Mach-E won. Why did the Mach-E win? I mean, all three were really outstanding, are really outstanding vehicles. In my opinion, and this, I'm just one juror, even though I'm president.
One juror of 50, actually.
I only get one set of votes.
Right.
But I'm not terribly surprised because of the significance of that vehicle, the message it sends, and also the execution of that vehicle, and also the versatility of that vehicle. I mean, who would have guessed a year ago that you'd see a Mustang Utility? And who would have given it credibility? Why would they do such a thing? Well, it's full electric. It has two different battery sizes available. But if you get the large size, it'll deliver 300-plus miles, full electric. It's not slow. On the contrary, it's quite quick. It's fun to drive. It's very heavy because it carries that much battery.
Right.
But
it's fun to drive, and it has that Mustang feel to it, or at least enough sporting feel that you can say a Mustang is not just slapped on the side of it.
At the local drive event they had for us, and you may have attended one on the West Coast.
I did.
But they had a slalom course. I would say it was not the greatest slalom course vehicle because of its weight. But out on twisty two lanes, it did very nicely. It would not be a penalty to drive it on a mountain road, and you could still have fun with it as you could with a conventional Mustang. And the other thing that I didn't mention is it's got the utility of a crossover. It's actually got real room inside.
Right.
Backseat and cargo room. It's larger than a Mustang, obviously, and a lot heavier. But combining all of those things, crossover utility, pure electric, and Mustang iconic brand.
It's a lot to like.
I think a lot of people were skeptical, maybe myself included. Was this the right thing to do, to put a Mustang badge on that thing? The more I look at it, the more I drove it. Yeah, I think they're onto something.
I think putting the Mustang name on it kind of focused this vehicle in a way that it wouldn't have been focused if it was named Ford, pick a name, right? Ford, something other than Mustang. I mean, it delivered the styling direction and helps, you know, suggest the styling direction.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it said, it has to be performance-oriented. Let's make it that.
I was going to mention the styling, too. Obviously, styling is subjective. And I'll be honest with you, when they unveiled this thing, what was it, a year ago or something? We saw it in L.A. unveiled.
Yes.
And I said, I don't know. It's kind of big, and I'm not sure. But then when I saw it again and drove it again, I think it has earned that Mustang badge, even in terms of its appearance. They've done a very nice job of making a Mustang-looking utility.
Right. Well, we kind of have made the deep dive into the individual vehicles here. And it's interesting that the first deep dive was on utility, because one thing that changed in 2020 was utilities became the biggest overall category. More than 50% of vehicles sold in 2020 were sport utility vehicles for the first time. So it's kind of apropos in a lot of ways, maybe the most important award, if you want to rank the importance of the awards, is not car of the year so much anymore or truck of the year, but it might be utility of the year. What do you think about that?
Well, it's not the biggest market segment yet, because I think trucks still are. But
trucks include sport utilities. So if you separated pickup trucks from the overall truck market, sport utilities are definitely the biggest.
But as you know, up until 2017, there were two NACTOY awards, car and truck. And that got increasingly difficult because the sport utilities and the crossover utilities, which we call them, which are car-based crossover, car-based utilities, basically. You take a body off a Honda Civic and put a CRV body on it, and it's a car-based vehicle, but now suddenly it's a utility, and those were considered trucks. So, as you know, in 2017, NACTOY chose to separate those out, make a new category and a third award, and that probably was the right thing to do. And as you say, it is the fastest growing segment of all sizes, very small ones and very large ones, like the new Cadillac Escalade, the Chevrolet Suburban, and the GMC Yukon.
Yeah, I mean,
and those are excellent vehicles. They didn't make the cut.
They didn't even make the finalist cut. So that shows you.
Right.
I mean, you could take a look at, say, the Escalade and the technology on the Cadillac Escalade and everything that it brings to the party. And in another year, that might well have been the utility of the year, just because what it offers, right? So it shows you how deep the field was this year.
And we are considering those large truck-based utilities as utilities, not as trucks, even though they're based on trucks, because that's the way the consumer perceives them as utility vehicles. So it makes sense to have them in that category.
Let's backtrack a little bit and talk about Elantra. I would say I'm also one of the jurors. I'm vice president of the organization, so I guess I'm speaking with some authority here. When you look at the cars involved, we had an individual car, a G80.
The Sentra.
We had the Sentra, a compact direct competitor to the Elantra, and then the Elantra line. Walk us through your thinking about that decision.
Well, I think it was a smart decision, first of all, for them to group them together, both from a public launch perspective, but also from a NAC toy competition perspective, because I think I can only speak for myself as one of 50 jurors, like you, but I think that was a consideration, the fact that there were three very distinct variants of this new Elantra coming out at almost the same time. And it wasn't just a single vehicle. You could go for the regular vehicle, you could go for the more fuel-efficient hybrid, or you could go for the more fun-to-drive, performance-oriented N-line. There's still another one coming, which was not considered this year, and that's the N itself, which is even higher performance.
Even higher performance,
like a track-capable version of it. That one's not available yet. But it's a smart... a smart strategy, I think, to launch them as a family.
Yeah.
And I'll bet that if Nissan could have done that, it would have been a tougher competition. As
yeah,
good as
I
that
think you're right,
is.
Because I think the Sentra itself is a great car, but it is more centered on a particular audience. And they've taken some chances with the Sentra, but you can say with the Elantra, it is a broader base. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure which one of the, if I had the four to choose from, if I had the Sentra or the various Elantra variants, which one I would choose for myself.
Sentra surprised everyone, I think, because the previous vehicle wearing that badge was nothing special. It was okay, nothing great. Sold okay, but not great in its segment. But this new one was a huge leap in every way, styling and features and quality and everything else. From the previous version, that surprised all of us, I think. And it's gotten a lot of good reviews, good kudos, very little negative about it. It's a strong competitor, and I'd be surprised. We haven't seen the vote totals yet from this last vote, but I'd be surprised if it wasn't a very close second.
Yeah.
And that's not to say the GV80 is not a terrific vehicle.
Yeah.
G80,
yes.
Is not a terrific vehicle. Also, it is.
It's just a more specialized vehicle.
Right.
Than
higher
the
price.
Other two, which are... much broader appeal to a compact sedan versus a luxury sedan. Let's talk a bit about trucks. I mean, F-150 has been the champ in terms of sales for 44 years. I mean, it is a cornerstone of what Ford Motor Company is doing. To you, how big a leap forward is this F-150 versus the previous one?
You know, to be honest, Jack, I'm not entirely qualified yet to answer that definitively because I haven't spent that much time in it. I have driven it, but it was fairly brief. It was another vehicle that was launched late, so they did well to get it out to us as jurors at all around the country and in Canada. So I don't have a lot of time with it yet. It seems that it's built on what was already, if not the leader, certainly the sales leader, but it took what was already the top-selling truck, didn't change it in appearance a whole lot, but added a lot of features and a lot of, I think, some additional capabilities. And I don't know why it would not continue to lead the segment as good as the Silverado and the Ram are.
Right.
I think.
Well, I agree. And I think adding the hybrid version and especially the power on board aspect of that, you know, essentially having generator capability or the ability to power a lot of things. I mean, that really spoke to me about, yeah, Ford is really paying attention to what the consumer, the buyer of this vehicle is going to want to do. In that case, it might be a tradesman or it might be somebody who's out camping and wants to have that capability. There were a lot of little touches, I think, in the Ford F-150 that really set it apart. And of course, it was competing, as you mentioned, against specialty vehicles that had been introduced in prior years and had actually done quite well in our judging over the course of prior years. So I think that's what really set the F-150 apart this time around.
It's a really tough market, and I know everybody, all of the engineers who engineer all three of these vehicles, I've interviewed the chief engineers in most cases through the years, and they're very much focused on the customer needs, preferences, priorities. They go out and talk to customers at store parking lots and things like that, at gas stations, to find out what do you like about the current vehicle, what do you like about the competition, what do you not like. They do a tremendous job of being customer focused, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I'm not talking about just Ford. I'm talking about all three.
Yeah, absolutely true. Well, let's talk a little bit about the organization, North American Car of the Year, our jurors. You're president of the organization. I'm very honored to serve as vice president and your vice president. Tell our listeners a bit about the organization.
Sure. Well, we keep mentioning that there are 50 of us. The jury is set at 50. We did have a few people fall out this year, and we added restocked,
members.
If
right.
you will,
yeah,
with
right.
very. We have a long list of very highly qualified, talented automotive journalists who would like to be on our jury, and we picked from those lists. We voted on them and did a little vetting of them to get back up to 50 very quickly. And one thing that's really interesting, and I think definitely unique about our jury, it is so diverse. And I don't mean diverse in terms of ethnicity so much as it is that too, but also in terms of who people work for, who people write for. It's now, I would say, very close to half self-employed. I mean, people like myself who are very busy, widely published freelancers for a number of outlets, and the other half long-term employees of various major outlets in most cases. But they all have different preferences. They all have different likes and dislikes. I'm sure we all evaluate and test the vehicles somewhat differently with a different set of priorities. And that's one of the beauties of it, because when you have 50 people, it's not, you know, a lot of times when people write about our choices, they say, we chose these vehicles, or we selected these vehicles, or we picked these vehicles. We don't do any of the above. We vote for them. We go through a series of three votes on the long list that was right. 43 this year, narrowing it down to the shorter list, which is the semifinalist. That's the first vote, then the semifinalist to the finalist, second vote, and then the final vote, which we did just last week, as you know, to pick the winners from the finalists. And it's not, in other words, it's not a subjective choice. It's not, these aren't the vehicles we happen to like the best, we individually or collectively. These are the vehicles that best meet the needs of the market. And
right.
we look at ride, handling, styling, value for money, fuel efficiency, all of the criteria.
Right. And I think because we have 50 jurors, we have maybe 50 different procedures to arrive at that. And I think instead of that being a weakness, that's a strength.
Exactly.
That we're looking at it
exactly.
from a very diverse point of view.
Right.
Another thing I think that's important to understand about our organization is it's a volunteer organization that is a nonprofit. Other award programs are from, maybe it might be from a magazine. One is from a magazine we both did a lot of work for
right.
back in the day, Motor Trend, where I was editor. Others are from organizations like Consumer Reports or something like that. Yeah. We are a group of independents, 50 of us, who make this, do these elections.
Yeah, and I think that's the strength of it. It's certainly not a weakness. I think that's what we're not, it's not an award given by a single outlet, publication, organization. It's a huge, diverse group of representatives of all kinds of outlets who do automotive journalism. And those include, I think we're something like 8 of us are Canadian. So we have a good representation north of the border as well. And that's important,
yeah,
too, for different perspectives.
We're North American Car of the Year, after all. One of the things I think that is important to understand about us, too, is that, again, as a nonprofit, any money that we take in either goes to the testing of the vehicles, the announcement of the vehicles, mm-hmm. and then we're announcing vehicles that we believe as a public service. Talk a bit about the public service nature of what we do and the charitable stuff that we do.
Well, yeah, Jack, that's a good question. I think if you're out there as Mr. or Mrs. Smith's consumer, you'd like as much as information, credible information, as possible from sources whom you trust and believe. And there's an awful lot of sources out there of information and reviews and criticisms of all these new vehicles. I'd like to think, and I think the data bears this out, that this is one of the top most trusted sources of information about the goodness, if you will, the worthiness, the value for money of all of these vehicles in the North American market. So I think that's important. I think the OEMs are very thrilled to get this. They see it as definitely a boost for their product's reputation and sales. It actually, research has shown that it does affect their sales
right.
when they
and
win
they
these awards.
And they see strong credibility in these awards.
Right.
Yeah.
And we'd like to think, and I think it's true, again, the data shows that the consumers also put a lot of stock in these awards, which vehicles win these awards. And I would think also semifinalists and even finalists. I mean, not just the winners.
Yeah.
We're pointing out what we, as a group of diverse jurors, think ought to be on their list or near yeah. the top of their list.
Yeah, we took something like, I think there were, what, like 70 or something, you know, potentials to begin with, and brought them down to 9 and then as finalists, and then brought them down to 3 that are the individual award winners in their 3 categories.
We had 43 on the original long list, and that's only either all new vehicles or very substantially new vehicles. We're not just a mid-cycle refresh where the vehicle gets a new grill and some new features. It's substantially new. A few of them were an existing vehicle that is almost all new because it's so substantially changed. So that narrows it down. But again, we started, that's a long list to start with, 43, and then 27 semifinalists.
Right.
I wanted to mention, you also mentioned the charity thing. For the
first
for the first time this year, NACDOY, and this was helped out by the Detroit Auto Dealers Association and North American International Auto Show, they offered us a sum of $20,000 a year ago to give to charity in their name, but our choice of which charity would receive that. We matched that amount, and NACDOY put up another $20,000, and we ended up with a jury vote, and we ended up giving those to two very worthy charitable organizations. And again, we had several selections, and we let the jury decide on which ones got the most votes.
Right. So very worthy stuff. And Gary Whitzenberg, thanks so much for being with us. We do appreciate the president of the North American Car of the Year jury. That I serve as the vice president. So, as I say, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jack. Always a pleasure.
Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back right here on America on the Road. So that was our interview with Gary Whitzenberg, who is president of the North American Car of the Year organization, a nonprofit organization that is designed for consumer service to help people understand what the best new vehicles are in the marketplace each year. We thank him so much for being with us. And another guy I've got to thank for being with us is our friend from Maine, our Maine man, Chris Teague. Thanks so much for co-hosting again this week, Chris. We do appreciate it.
Thank you, Jack, for having me again, and thanks, everyone, for listening. If you like what you heard, please hit the subscribe button, leave us a review. That'll help us continue to grow and get in front of more people who we can bring along for the ride, at least we hope.
Absolutely, we hope, and we think that will actually happen. We're actually gaining listeners every week, and we're very happy about that. We thank you for passing us along. We also should pass along good wishes to Chris because he's moving from house to house. And that's going to take place over the course of the next several weeks. So let's wish him well doing that. And I wish all of you well out there in listener land for listening to us. And if you like the show, you might actually like my book, The GR Factor, Unleashing the Undeniable Power of the Golden Rule. It's a book that's available in a lot of different places, including on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, and local bookstores. And we suggest you support your local bookstores and local retailers when you can. So by all means, do that. And by all means, please join us again next time for another edition of America on the Road.